First of all, I just want to say welcome to Bazile and Doria as usual. This week we're talking about the new release, which is 0.06. Is that right?
0.6.
0.6. What did I say?
0.06, so 6 hundredths instead of 60%.
I should be fired for that one. Yeah, 0.6 is
the. It's already happened. We've automated it.
Yeah, so anyway, we've released, I think it was on Sunday, is that right? 0.6. And so I guess the way I wanted to open this up is, can we talk about why, or sort of the philosophy of 0.6 in terms of why we're going for trying to get closer and closer to an unbreakable release. Like we're getting closer and closer to that, and I think by 1.0 we will say, okay, this is now the structure and protocol of this thing is not going to change anymore. Everything's backward compatible.
Right.
Right?
Well, that's the reason of that's the first release, 1.0. And that the what we're doing right now is like a pretty standard sort of like development process of like cutting what you could call like release candidates for that, and then figuring out what's wrong with them, and then going back and doing that again, and doing that until we can't find any problems and we're ready to commit to a protocol forever. So like just to be clear, like that just because like the numbers line up this way doesn't mean like it's like, oh, we're gonna do 6, 7, 8, 9 and then it's 1.0. Like you can do 0.6, 0.9, 0.10, 0.12. So it's not, you know, and there's also nothing saying you have to get to 0.9 before you get to 1.0. So that's not what's going on. 1.0 is
We're gonna count up. We're gonna count up numbers less than one until it's ready. And this is, I think, the closeness to one of 0.6 is meant to mostly, I think, give a feel for where we are in the process of, you know, committing to keeping the API stable and backwards compatible, and meaning to say that it's months, not years.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And so let's talk about like why that's important, or why we're doing this. So like, yeah.
Let's talk about it in two ways. I'll let you do the first one first, which is talk about it first, just practically for developers and projects and protocols, what it means. And then I'll talk about it, maybe not spiritually is probably not the right word, but more like the less obvious
The
benefits,
historical,
sort of intangible. Well, there's also a lot of intangible, not obvious benefits, to doing it, to forcing yourself to do this. And I can talk about them in a historical context.
Okay. Well, so for developers, right, you need to present them a stable release, and a stable platform. So when you use like library software, a release gets cut, and then you usually like, you know, in most systems, like you would link to that specific version of that library. So even if a new version came out, you would still have the old version as your dependency in your code. And that's great because it's never going to change because it's static. It's like statically linked, hopefully. But when you're using a platform, that's not really possible because you can't, like, you're not using a static copy of the platform. The platform is running on somebody else's computer, and like they might want to upgrade, and then your program would have a problem with that if the upgrade was not perfectly backwards compatible. So the biggest inspiration and blueprint here is like Ethereum. I mean, actually, there are other blockchains too. Like Bitcoin is like this to a slightly different philosophical degree. But like with Ethereum, you had a project that was under development for, you know, about a year, and then a version one was released and just forever made backwards compatible. And so that's the kind of thing where that's what you need to do in order to enable the kind of development that we need to have in order to make this a useful system, right? That kind of development is permissionless
And
development.
contracts like from Ethereum in 2016 still run. Like they're still there, they still
Exactly.
work.
And there have been soft forks and hard forks and upgrades to the Solidity compiler and, you know, the opcodes and
And
everything.
they still
But
run.
the engineering skill comes from engineering that backwards compatibility, where you say, okay, every change that we make to this system is going to be performed in such a way that people can follow along, and old code doesn't have to do anything to remain usable. And so we're going to do that exact same thing starting with 1.0. And we're already doing it. We're already doing it, by the way, as like a sort of a dry run or a practice run between our releases. And we're taking very careful note of like, oh, here's a thing. Here's a piece of the system that can't be changed in that way. So we better make those changes now because we're going to be stuck with them. And that's what this process is really useful for. So yeah, Bazil, what do you want to add to that?
Oh man, well, so I think you've kind of captured it. I think the Ethereum analogy captures so much that you don't even have to say much more, where it's like people know what that feels like to have something that's released and that people can reliably program to for, it's almost a decade now. We're probably about another year and we're about a decade into that. Which is pretty impressive because it is a general Turing complete programming system that is basically an operating system, just at, you know, very low bandwidth. So such a thing can be done, I think, is like one of the first parts to recognize, even with a lot of other upgrades happening around, like, you know, happening around it, you can make it so the API is backwards compatible and old stuff keeps working. So I guess it's like that thing of like, you know, it's really important for humans to have proofs of concept, because once you know that something can be done, you're much more likely to like do it and to try to do it. So yeah, that's good. Are there any more sort of practical benefits you want to talk about before I talk about the more intangible or less obvious ones from pushing your project to get to this state?
I mean, tangible for developers is just, I think the big one is like permissionlessness, where you can just come in and you don't need to like ask the team, hey, like, can I make this app? Is this going to be okay? Is anybody else like, the thing that really makes a project like this viable is when people can come in and without any communication or like, you know, sign off from the team, they can do something really valuable. So that's what we're going
to do. When it's like autist or introvert or autist compatible.
Yeah.
And keep throwing it around. You have like, you know, Turing completeness, ergonomic completeness, and then like autist completeness, where your project can have someone who doesn't want to talk to any of you and wants to figure everything out in their head can just like build stuff and release it and it works.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, onto the philosophy.
Well, so it's a very practical philosophy. So it's like, okay, I think there's some really, really real and important benefits you get from forcing yourself to hit this backwards compatibility at a relatively early stage. And probably the first one is that it forces you to build applications from a very early stage, because you don't have the option to tell yourself that, oh, we'll do applications later when we're in this, like, you know, much more beautiful state 5 years from now. Or even like, look, we could use like real examples of when we were Ookbar and we were building on Urbit. You know, we were like, okay, we're building these applications, but we're sort of not expecting them to have their full form now. And we're expecting to have to make a ton of changes that could like just drastically impact what we have or whether it's viable or whatever. And we kind of accepted that and went along with it. And it turned out that not having, you know, the ability to build applications where you could depend on the API not shifting or stuff working early on ended up like, you know, when people criticize us, it's kind of insanely to me, but whatever, of, oh, you built on this for so long, you were committed to it, and then you switched, what happened? That comes from not having, you know, used a system that was forcing itself to be backwards compatible early and wasn't really forcing itself to like build the applications it needed in order to see whether it could even be backwards compatible. And that's actually how you can run into these, if you don't sort of force yourself to do that, and it's very tempting not to, it's very comforting to be like, you know what, this will be ready later, we won't have people use it now, da da da. You can do that, and then you like can spend, you can actually like very easily get multiple years down the road.
Years. It's wild. Years.
Many, many such cases. Yeah. So the other thing is, in terms of how it forces you to build applications, is if you want to actually cut one of these releases, you very much need to make sure that You know, it does support all the applications that you want. And as a result, when you get nearer to your backwards compatibility point, you know, to our 1.0, you actually have a lot of applications at that point, or a lot of proofs of concept, or a lot of jumping off points. And so I think we have a number of very interesting things we're doing internally, like very advanced but simple ZK rollups as infrastructure, you know, games built on top of that. LLMs connected to, you know, the blockchain, connected to ZK, doing stuff. And it's all stuff we've kind of had to do. It's very interesting. We'll release some of it in the next, like, you know, kind of 3 to 10 days, and there'll be more of it coming. But it's all stuff we had to write in order to make sure that our system even could do those things. So you also get the benefit of, like, you're in a better position for adoption, which is really critical for these types of, you know, more clean, like, you know, clean slate systems. You really need adoption. And you're in a better position for it because you've been building the stuff, making sure you can build it, doing that. So I think the intangible benefits are the main one is you can't go down a rabbit hole. And the other is you're much better positioned for later adoption and knowing what the possible use cases of your system are and what its strong and weak points are, because you've, like, had to force yourself to explore those in order to even get ready to release it. And those are really significant benefits, because they speak to, you know, will you actually deliver this, or is it vaporware? And also, when you deliver it, what are the odds that, like, either people want it or you can iterate it into something that people want? And those are just really, really, really critical questions that are very painful, and it's tempting to keep on the back burner. And so a lot of the traditional software world knows this very well. And so if you kind of look at everything that YC recommends and what they do, it pretty much all reduces to get stuff out there, force yourself to actually try to be building things that someone might want to use. Essentially, it's this idea of, like, if you have an idea, test it with applications and make sure that, like, you know, you're actually forcing yourself to do it, because they know, I mean, that the big temptation of engineers is to never actually subject your thing to that, because that's very painful, because a lot of the time people don't want it, or it actually can't support the applications that you want, or you're going to have to try pretty hard to figure out what those are. And that's a very emotionally painful process for many engineers. And this is a way of forcing yourself through that pain early, and also building a culture for your team, your project, everyone who comes into it, that, like, you know, is like, okay, we're going to, you know, we're going to eat that pain. We're going to try to do it. This is not the same as just build slapdash things that you throw away or engineer stuff badly, because the entire goal of it is to produce something that's kind of rock solid and backwards compatible. But the way you do that is by going through that more emotionally painful process. And if I'm going to offer explicit criticisms of myself or people in Urbit, like, you know, when we were there, people I see, they're very obviously emotionally avoidant of that. And this is not a unique criticism to me. I used to have my own issues with him, but when I was on the board of the Urbit Foundation, we would, you know, talk to Balaji often, because he was also on it, and that was basically his criticism, is that you guys are, like, essentially you guys are nerds who don't want to feel the pain of putting your thing in the real world and having people reject it and then having to iterate from there.
It's
he would say this a lot, and he was right.
It's funny how like effective of a coping strategy it is to say that, like, you know, the Dune meme, our plans are measured in centuries, you know, it's very effective for, like, a certain, like, you know, smart person to be like, oh, well, that criticism doesn't apply to me because, like, I'm thinking bigger than you are. Like, my time scale is longer. My ambitions are higher, actually. And I'm not going to, there's, like, a very easy cope of, like, I'm not going to subject myself to your, like, SaaS founder principles because yes, we're building something more important than that. It's like, no, those principles they're not small and iterate. It's not like think small and iterate because your project is small and needs to iterate. It's literally like it, because it won't work otherwise. It literally, it's just, yeah.
I really, really, really recommend, Josh, maybe you can put it in the show notes or something, like listening to Mark Andreessen's podcast with Dwarkesh, because Dwarkesh is this, like, you know, very smart, like, early 20s guy who's obviously very prone to being able to fall into that trap. And, you know, he like asked Andreessen straight up, like, you know, do you think it'd be better for VC if you were allocating on, you know, able to allocate on 25-year timeframes, for example, or even longer? And I think he definitely sort of wanted the answer of, yeah, we're, like, forced by the pressure of our LPs to, like, deploy capital, and, like, you know, we have to return the fund in this time. And Andreessen was just like, no, Like it wouldn't change anything at all. And like whenever you invest in something on that long a time frame, what really happens is, in the very best case, you get very smart people to go build something for a very long time that becomes very disconnected from everything else in the world. And then after like, you know, 10 years, you have to see like, does this thing they've built even have any way to integrate with where the rest of the world is? And the answer is basically always no. And I think it's like a really, again, I think the, again, someone who was in this, our plans are measured in centuries kind of cope, their immediate reaction would be like, yeah, typical like VC saying that. And I don't know. I mean, Marc Andreessen wrote some of like the most foundational software to the internet, has been like an incredibly successful investor. And like that, the general industry he's in keeps producing stuff that keeps moving forward while the theory sell people dome. And, you know, I would definitely like want to ask yourself if you were in that boat, which I probably have been at times in my life for sure. Like, are you missing something?
Yeah.
Like, does maybe the like, you know, multi-billionaire who's written like, you know, much more important software than you ever have know something that you don't? Might be a useful question to ask.
You point. Know, that brings up the question of humility when it comes to like being an engineer. Like, it's really important to be humble and realistic about your skills. I think when you talk to somebody,
and also about like the nature of reality and its fundamental complexity. But continue.
Of course, but like, I mean, you know, I always like, I don't know, I always like, have to remind myself, you know, to like not go crazy on something, because like, and it's very easy to remind myself, like the world does it for me because I see people who are, you know, really, really brilliant, like doing crazy things. Right. And so like, when you see that, like, it's like, oh man, like there are people out there who can like just engineer circles around me in their sleep. Like those people are out there. And like, basically like you lose the ability, like it's not logically possible for you to be humble the way you need to be, if you reject certain standard practices or advice. I think this is like relevant for us right now, because we went from a strategy of like sort of like betting, like going all in and like doubling and tripling down on like the sort of like outsider tech, to being very like, you know, standard practices, right? Like WASM is like, you know, it's Google, it's Meta, it's Amazon, right? This is
the biggest charge that people will level against us. Yeah. Like, you sold out, like, bro, yeah. You're using like, you know, stuff that like people, and I think like, you can keep talking about it, but I think that reveals a lot more about the person who's like saying it.
I mean, the cool thing is like, once you like get over yourself and like are able to have the humility to say like, oh yeah, like this piece of software was engineered by like dozens of people who are like just significantly smarter and better engineers than me, is like, you get to free yourself up to like actually try things and do things that are going to be potentially valuable. Cause if you're like an entrepreneurial kind of person and you want to make your mark on the world, you want to contribute something to software, but you can recognize that you're not going to compete. You're not going to be able to compete on like math with like a quant trader, right? Like you have to be like, oh, okay, well, like where can I be of value in that system? Like what can I contribute to that? And so for us, like, you know, we have a unique set of experiences around peer-to-peer software, and we know like the a lot of failure points that other people don't know about yet, because they're like, there is this like knowledge gap in terms of what does it look like to have every user run a personal node and run this software that gets upgraded over the network and is designed to be robust and has like a state machine that gets shared across the network. Like, we know about that because we built a bunch of those apps, and so now we get to go and be like, okay, like taking that knowledge, having the level of humility, how can we combine those things to like make some mark on software to really like be of use, be of service? So I feel really good about like what we're doing in terms of that. Like, I think it is making a mark there. So yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think there is also this thing of like, when you're in the theory cell mode, it's very easy to convince yourself that
tangential aspects of the problem are the main thing. So like you're really into like, oh, I'm not using a normie stack or normie languages. And you can very easily lose sight of the essential problem that you're trying to solve, which is like all this stuff that you're saying around peer-to-peer computing and how it actually works, et cetera, right? And so I think that, again, it's like this massive, again, it's this massive form of avoidance of the actual part of the problem in order to, like, look, I'll just be honest. And like engineers like fun things. And there is nothing more fun than playing with stuff from the ground up and kind of getting it to work and feeling that. And honestly, in life, you have to make a decision as to what you want to do. Like, is your goal to sort of tickle your brain? And like, and I don't think comparisons to masturbation are out of line here. Or do you have something that you actually want to produce? And like, I can't really judge the choice of kind of essentially sitting in your mind room jacking it all the time. But you're very unlikely to produce something because of the just essential complexity of reality. So being able to like force yourself to like focus on the crux of the problem is, you know, how you get out of that. And, you know, some people just get tired of jacking it at a certain point. Some people don't. I know those people.
So let's talk about like the concrete things that we're doing to like stay out of that state. Cause I think like over the past, like, 2 months especially, we've really like kicked it into high gear of like staying away from that. So that's related to the topic of the space, is like 0.6 is like we're taking this release candidate and we are building apps on top of it that we intend to distribute on our app store and see if they work, right? And like see if they can actually like be robust. And so the purpose of that exercise is to have really small cycles of development where you would say, hey, look, I'm getting a lot of static from the Zoom.
Oh, one second.
I can talk for a minute or two here. I've got a thing to say. But if we get really small timelines by doing these little apps, because, you know, first of all, if the app takes too long to develop on the system, then we need to change something about the system, because part of the reason to design an OS like this is so app development is really fast. So we can say, all right, take 10 days to develop an app and see like how far can you get during that period of time. That measures how close we are in one dimension. The other dimension is, given that app that you just built, like what's broken about it? What sucks about it? Like, could this be an actual consumer product? Could you take this to somebody and raise some money in order to continue its development and try to onboard, you know, many, many users and make it a profitable company? And if the answer is no, then why? And so for our apps right now, we're building some interesting little use cases. So like one of those is, should I talk about the things that we're doing right now?
Yeah.
Is that good? Is that good radio? Yeah.
Yeah, do it real quick, and maybe with like trying to then pull it back to, for those types of things, why it's important for us to be able to stabilize the system.
Okay, yeah, for sure. So like one of those things is like this negotiator tool, which is designed to help you sell your NFTs. And this is, you know, you know, we didn't build the OS in order to do things like this, although it is very cool, actually. I've been playing with it and it's really fun. You have a large language model running somewhere, either locally or remotely, that you want to use as your brain. You have an NFT that you want to sell to somebody, and you have a Telegram bot. You have a, you know, Telegram account. You post this bot and anybody can chat with it and negotiate a price for your asset. And then if the negotiation is successful, they can complete the sale. So the LLM is actually like fully capable of selling your NFT. And it has, there's a rule set around which it must conform, and you have checks in code to make sure that you get a certain price and things like that. But it's pre-approved at that price and beyond to actually complete the sale. And so this is like, I think it's a really great example of stuff you can do on this system, because it has like three totally separate big pieces of chunky technology that it integrates in, like, you know, a couple hundred lines of code. That's just really the beauty of the integrated OS. So you've got You've got your LLM API that you're hooking up and talking to. You've got your Telegram channel that you're running a bot in, and then you've got your on-chain asset that you're doing signing and selling of. There's actually a fourth thing, which is that you can generate a ZK proof of the execution of this trade, and have that sort of act as like a backstop for LLM, like, you know, auditing or verification of like quality. You don't actually prove like the completions, but you prove like the actions that it takes inside of your system, which is actually I think potentially like a better way to engineer that kind of thing, because like ZK ML is a very big, you know, it's a very like bubbly thing, but like it's very like ML is already really high on the computational stack. Like running an LLM is a very computationally intensive thing, right? It's one of the most computationally intensive things that people actually want to do. And so it's logically like one of the last things that'll be really performant in ZK, which has, you know, some orders of magnitude slowdowns. So like, don't run that in the ML, or don't run that in the ZK, but run the actions that it takes. Anyway, that's the little toy. That's the integrations. We've got some other stuff too, but Bazil, like, is that, what did you want to say about like what this says about our system itself?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like how it matters, because it's not immediately obvious how being able to do those proofs of concept relates to backwards compatibility. I guess like being able to do all of them sort of shows that you're closer to being able to freeze. I think there's also something I can't quite put my finger on, but it seems real, of like being like doing it and then being able to later take that proof of concept and build on it further without having to have everything break. Right. Feels like it could compound.
Yeah. No, so that's the critical thing, is like if somebody builds out a tool for this, like that has to just be static. That can't be like a sort of like leaky or like wobbly dependency. So if somebody writes like a library for like Telegram bots, like that can't be something that's it actually hasn't been touched in 6 months.
You know what?
And then it falls apart.
Yeah, you know what it is? It's that like you can build libraries and they'll keep working, because very often in the process of doing this stuff, you'll discover useful library things. And if that has to keep getting thrown away every time, it's very, very hard for your system to advance. Even if it breaks in a very small way due to a very small change in code, that's already devastating, because the cost for someone to boot up mentally and figure out what's going on will, in 99% of cases, and that might even be low, result in the thing getting thrown away.
You guys are kind of like what you're talking about now is actually, I think, what Doria has talked about, which is like moving from this idea of like hyperstructures to hyper apps. So like supporting, doing all the things that support this this idea of the hyper app. Am I correct in assuming that we're kind of biting around the edges of that? So like,
Before we get to the hyper app, I think before we get to that, I think there's already something that I had never thought of, which is the library aspect, which is, we just say it one more time to be clear. In the course of feeling out a problem, you will often discover small libraries or things you can make better, which often, you know, that will outlive the app itself in very, very many cases, and be used by other projects you do, and then that library code will be used by other people. And if it has to keep getting thrown away and getting rewritten every time, you never really progress. And actually, if I was going to make a kind of, having written such libraries in Urbit, if I was going to make sort of a concrete criticism of stuff that happened, I think that happened like a lot, even more than I think app composability was maybe even less of an issue than the fact that there was a lot of code rot. You couldn't build things and have them like, you know, keep going over time.
And that gets reflected, by the way, in the poverty of libraries that are out there. So, I mean, you know, it's not something that has to be proven. It's sort of self-evident.
Well, it doesn't have to be proven, but it does have to be like diagnosed, where you're like, okay, why did it feel like stuff wasn't advancing? And I think that's a big reason that I had never put my finger on before until now, which is that you do this stuff, you have, you know, reasonably smart people exploring things, trying to build things. And then the thing they did couldn't be, usually the way it'll work is you'll build something, a Telegram API in building the LLM negotiator, and a couple months later, and then on your next thing, you'll build another thing using that. And then maybe you'll come back to it later. And if it just works, you'll get booted right up into Telegram and probably make something interesting there. And then at that point, maybe someone else will build a thing on top of that. And if you have your original library not work when you come back months later, that just never happens.
Yeah.
And it's actually very hard to, the only way you can see the idea of software having never happened is that you just start to notice that stuff is taking a long time. And the reason stuff is taking a long time is software, it can be amazingly fast or amazingly slow to build. If it's compounding and you can use stuff from before, it'll go incredibly fast and people are often shocked by it. And if you're not compounding, it's almost the exact opposite, where it actually goes much slower in progress than physical things. Because at least for a physical thing, you know, you have a table that's wrong. You could chop off a little bit of it. And in this case, you have to actually dig into the code and figure out what's wrong. You can't just eyeball it, chop off a little bit and make it work in the corner of your new room. And so this is just like a fundamental philosophical thing about software, where everyone knows that it, you know, can either overrun time by a lot or also produce these incredible productivity gains. And it always comes down to, are you compounding or decaying?
Mm, yeah, good way of putting it. I mean, that's basically why we're always so anxious to get our own sort of kernel team to be building user space apps, because like, you need to go and like check your work, basically. Like if you put something out, like you have to make sure it actually works. And it's actually kind of annoying for you as like the person who just built this thing, because you want to move on to the next thing. So it's emotionally like difficult to say, oh no, I actually have to like go and make sure this is robust. Cause the way something gets to be stable in the way that you are describing as necessary for the compounding effects,
mm-hmm.
Somebody does need to go and like make it stable, and they need to like lock in and commit to an API, to a system. That somebody needs to like say, yep, okay, I'm committing to this. This is my 1.0, and it's not going to change. And you know, like, of course, the thing with software is like, you know, it does have to change over time, right? I want to use Ethereum as an example again, because I think it's still the best example of like a group of people doing this in a decentralized way to boot. But like, look at how Ethereum works and like how many things have changed from like 10 years ago. And it's significant. Like the protocol has fundamentally changed. Like the token economics have been altered massively, right? And big parts of the system have changed. And yet there's that backwards compatibility. So one, that's possible. It takes a lot of extra work, but it's possible. But then two, look at Ethereum 10 years from now. Like everybody kind of knows, like the core team is very much in acceptance of the fact that like, yeah, no, ZK rollups and validiums and new data structures that we haven't implemented yet are going to dominate this thing. And it dominated in the sense that like people probably won't be, well, people probably won't be doing transactions on layer one. People probably won't be writing Solidity, right? People will be doing like very different things to what we're doing now. And yet, like, those massive technological changes are going to be absorbed by the system because of basically stability engineering. That's a really inspiring thing to say, like, hey, look, like, we're building like an operating system that runs WASM apps. Things are going to change. Like WASI, like I can talk about the sort of like long-term timeline for like the world of WASM, because it's very exciting. There's going to be big changes. We're going to absorb those, you know, and also with the changes that Ethereum is making, like we are also going to absorb those, because that's the place where, you know, a lot of blockchain activity is going to occur, and we need to integrate with that. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, that's like.
Do you want to move on to that?
A lot of things. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, I do just want to ask if anybody wants to raise their hand, please go ahead, and I'll get to you when we have a moment. But now that we have finished that conversation, do you want to talk about hyperstructures and hyperapps? Dory, I might. put that one to you.
No, yeah, absolutely. So this is like a really...
And then I'm going to ask you like an antagonistic question about them after you do it.
Sure, sure. So hyperstructures is a really cool concept. We talked about it, like we linked it, like we teased it a couple spaces ago, but like, yeah, it's they're these permissionless like protocols that run forever and are positive sum for participants. And so you can look at like blockchains as one of those things and protocols on chain, like, you know, Uniswap, or you know, a lending protocol, or Maker is like a hyperstructure, right? And these are really cool things. This is like a very, very attractive to engineers especially, but also people who want to do cool things. So we've been kind of trying to fiddle with the idea of like, what does that look like as like an app? Because these structures, and even just clear in the examples I've given, are like very much protocols. They're very raw. There's in the original blog post, there's a lot of like brutalism imagery, which I think is very accurate because it is sort of like the skeletal outer structure of a machine that's humming and whirring. But it's very hard to use it as a human. It's actually very intimidating. And this actually gets reflected in using these on-chain protocols, because if you're swapping in Uniswap, you are a victim of a very complex and powerful machine that involves like quite a bit of stuff going on that you're not privy to, MEV sandwiching and all that. And so how do you make that into an app that like a person can just like use, like by tapping buttons and on their phone or on their computer or whatever? And that's why we're building this like peer-to-peer OS, is to try to enable that. Now, the thing that's in common and gets into the point of like why we're doing this release schedule and what we're trying to stabilize is that a hyper app does need to retain the properties of a hyperstructure, where it's got to be permissionlessly composable. One, it's got to just exist out in the digital space and anybody can plug into it, build on top of it like Lego blocks, you know, use its API, hack it, hack around it, all that stuff. So in order to get to that, it has to be stable. And if it's going to be stable, the underlying system supporting it, of course, also has to be stable. So that's sort of the big thing there.
Then you want to talk about then maybe what are the things that still have to be done between like 0.6 and 1.0 to get us to utter stability?
Okay, well, I'll start with like some of the nice stuff that doesn't have to be done, which is good. So in the process of building the system, one of the ways we've been able to like move pretty fast is that we know that we only have to get the semantics right in order to stabilize. And so what I mean by that is like literally the API interfaces, like the places where different parts of software are communicating with one another, the boundaries, those have to be stable. The internals don't have to be as stable. You can completely rewrite the internals and redo the implementation as long as like you stick to that backwards, like that's what backwards compatibility is, like quite literally at an engineering level. So like for something like security, let's talk about like our capabilities system, and what we did there. So we built out the API, like the kernel functions, the functions that an app has access to, right? The places that these get stored, what their format looks like. We built out a capabilities-based security system for the OS. And that's the thing where like, there is an API. You have to be able to ingest capabilities, parse capabilities, create new capabilities, and send them between processes. Okay, that's the API. It's minimal. It's there. If that API doesn't exist and you have to make it later, like obviously that's going to be a breaking change because you are changing the API. But once the API exists, I'm sure there are like critical vulnerabilities in our implementation. There's a block of text on the you know, repo readme that says this software is unaudited and please use it at your own risk. That's very true, right? Like we're not at the level of saying, hey, look, you know, this capabilities-based security system, not only is the API frozen, but there's no, this will never fail, right? This will protect your most critical data, billions of dollars. That's obviously not true. We want to get it to that point, but that can happen after the API is frozen, which is really nice. But the API has to exist for that to happen. So the kind of stuff that we're doing between 0.6 and 1.0 is getting those APIs right. So that means like building apps that use and manipulate those APIs in every kind of way. You need 100% coverage, right? So we're using those things and building those things. And when we discover things that are bad, I actually was just messaging in the dev support channel in our Discord late last night, because I have I have an issue with a part of our system API, which is the on exit property of a process. So when a process exits, it's allowed to sort of tell the kernel what it wants to happen to it. So right now we have like options of you can restart, nothing can happen, or you can fire off a set number of requests. And I'm sort of starting to take issue with that, because I'm wondering, you know, whether or not a process might want to restart, but also fire off requests. And so that's the kind of thinking where it's like, oh, I need to build apps that use this tool. I need to get a feel for it and decide, is this API good enough as is, or does it need to make a breaking change? And that all has to happen before 1.0. So that's what's going on.
With regard to Hyper apps, how would you say that they're different from something like Arweave OS? Because it seems like that's pretty similar in terms of we're making this system that's basically a blockchain, but like enables off-chain computation and stability of apps. And maybe I have my own answers, but I'm curious what you think of that. Because it seems like in doing Hyper apps, we start to maybe not lose some of our advantages, but definitely lose some of our relative advantages.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. I don't know like everything about their system, so I can't like point to like specific things that are going to be like no good there or better elsewhere. But I do agree with your point that like a Hyper app, by the description that I gave, is somewhat more suited to a kind of always blockchain environment than a regular app. And so the context there for other people is that like when you're building a piece of software, like one of the options that a lot of people in crypto have advocated for kind of a long time is just to have an app that can run sort of quote unquote entirely on chain and just really scale the chain up in order to make that possible, right? So this is kind of what Arweave OS has done, is like built sort of a very like, you know, parallel hyperscaled chain that governs the interactions between these nodes. So our belief, of course, is that that's sort of not optimal for a lot of app use cases. But, you know, Hyper apps, this is a valid criticism there. Could be maybe better suited for that always on-chain environment.
So I guess what I was saying is like, I think that like the criticism is sort of valid, but I think it ignores like what people want to do with Hyper apps, where I think that they're maybe the start of the story and not the end, where you're trying to get this like very beefy, powerful thing happening in on-chain, off-chain, being very permissionless and composable. And then there's all the other stuff that you want to put around that in your backend. And I do think that one pretty big advantage we're going to have is getting rid of any impedance mismatches there and being able to give really easy to run code things around it. So it's kind of like your Hyper app plus. Like you have your Hyper app, but then you'll be able to add other stuff into it. Like, you know, again, like pretty much anything that you want to hit with the provider model, like external powerful resources that are either centralized or run decentralized but commoditized, I think we want to make like a lot easier to plug in there. And I think is like a pretty big focus of what we're doing.
Yeah, you know, that's something that we talked about last week that I think is worth bringing up again, is like programs that still ought to run in a centralized way. Oracles, essentially, right? Services that
there's services, oracles, high computation stuff, high resource stuff where it's very, very, essentially, I think there's this irreducible case of you're doing something that takes a lot of resources, and it's very, very expensive to prove in a game theoretic or programmatic sense that you reliably provided those resources. And so what you end up needing is some form of like trust or contract.
Yeah. So once you acknowledge that and you live in that reality, how do you integrate that data and how do you integrate that interface into this permissionless composable world? And that's just an engineering question. So we're just sort of like trying to, very, very meat and potatoes, just iterate towards that, do that, the work that Hollyum is doing is very related to that, and we're proving that out.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. I mean, that's like a big thing there.
We're coming up on
what else? I mean, we're getting an hour. I think like I almost don't want to give too much more content.
Yeah. Do we just want to quickly run through? Because I don't think we ever really said actually what the thing, what components are being released, or you know, sort of like what's in this update. I can run through some, but maybe.
Oh, Ben, you should talk about Ben, why don't you talk about Doria? Sorry, my bad. What's in it front, like that's sort of new or that we're just starting to
right.
test out and make sure it's stable? There's right. stuff that's been in here for a while, and then some stuff that's pretty
sure,
new.
Sure. Well, one thing is that like if you're a developer who's curious, we really do now have a stable platform for you to mess around on. So you can download Kit, which is our development toolkit. It's a really nice piece of software, really nice harness for building and testing apps. You can download that on your computer and you can boot a fake node, you can boot a real node, and you can write software and you can install it on your node and you can play with it. I'm very happy with the sort of first part of that onboarding process. The things that have changed are just some of the core APIs that apps are going to use. So we made some changes. I think the biggest changes happened with like the ETH provider, which is it changed because we really added it in this release as a big part of the system. Essentially, apps via the runtime have access to reads and writes to EVM chains that use the ETH RPC protocol. So you can add a provider. That provider can be a traditional like RPC URL, which could be running locally, it could be running remotely, or that provider can be another node on the Keynode network. So you can use the peer-to-peer network that we've built as a way to get chain data and submit chain data via RPC. So that's a big piece. That API has changed in order to accommodate that new power. And that's all documented in the book and ready to use. I have some good examples of apps that use that code, and we're going to continue to make more. Another place that there were some changes was like the HTTP server. So the API for serving static, HTTP content or reading from paths, that changed a little bit. Let's see what else. The login changed because we've been testing that part of the system in a real way for the first time with our hosting platform. So we're building out an open source hosting platform that people will be able to like spin up and use as part of their applications, because that's going to be a very easy onboarding flow. Like if you're building a consumer application on a peer-to-peer network and you want to onboard users, you should have a hosting platform like sort of built into your company. So we'll have that. And the changes there were mostly about like, creating a password, resetting a password and keeping your nodes secure, in a hosted environment. So we made some changes there. Those aren't really relevant though to application developers.
I think the big thing is probably ETH, and you can build on
yeah.
it. Like you can come and we won't tell you, oh, but be careful. Like we might break this. Like there's a very high chance that whatever you do against our API will remain the
same. There's a high chance, but to be fair, there will be changes. We're not at 1.0 yet, so you should. It's a beta.
I think they're going to be, right.
But the changes will be
minimal. Yeah, I mean, they're look. It's beta. They're likely to smaller, but it is different from like this is going to break in a couple days. Probably like we don't want to support it. It's different and important.
And another place that I'll talk about that is like in the versioning of like system components versus apps. So in our kernel, when we like ingest a WASM application and we run it against our virtual machine, like there are parts of that system that are very much under construction at the layer beneath us. So notably, we're using the component model for WASM, which is a spec that is in beta for running WASM apps as, quote unquote system components. The tooling that those apps use to present their interface, which of course we sort of like use the kernel as a harness for, that's under development. So we're using pieces of software developed by the WASM team the Bytecode Alliance, we're using Git hashes, right? So we're committing, you know, we're statically linking parts of their code that are very much under development and subject to breaking changes. How are we going to make that stable for people? Well, one is the static linking part of that, but two is just version control and backwards compatibility. So there is a field when you create an app to tell the kernel what version of the kernel you're using, right? This is, if you've written Solidity, the top of the contract, you say, oh, what, you know, what compiler am I using? You assign a version to your code, and when the kernel ingests that code, it just matches that against the version, and those versions are static. So there you go. And then you have backwards compatibility. So that's one of those places where, like, there could be huge sweeping changes, and yet the code that was written for the old version will still be runnable. It might not be encouraged. It might be, you know, deprecated, depreciated, whatever, but it'll still be runnable.
I think that, like, covers just about everything.
Great. I'll give people, like, the briefest moment to raise your hand if you want to ask a question. Otherwise, we're going to move to the end there. Anybody want to raise their hand? No? Forever hold your peace? I will. I'll note while I'm waiting that the count of the word robust was 3, Edgar. So you got 3 robust, which means 3 shots, I think. So anybody playing along?
It's not bad. It's a reasonable,
reasonable amount of robusts for our technology.
Yeah, I mean, very, you know, I might not get as much work done after I take them, but it's the rules are rules.
You get enough work done.
This is the podcast game for anyone playing at home. How robust is our technology? All right, so I don't see any hands, so I'll just go ahead and wrap it up, which is to say that you'll see this in the show notes, the links in the show notes, and also as a reply to this space, there will be links to our website where you can find our keynote book, which is the documentation. So if you're interested in developing, you can read the documentation. There's also going to be a link to our Discord, which all of our developers hang out in the Discord. So if you have any questions about anything related to Keynode primarily, you can join us in the Discord. And thanks to Bazil and Doria once again for catching us up this week on what's happening on Keynode. So until next time.
Yeah.
Thank you very much,
gentlemen. All right. Later, everyone.
Bye.